Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Jackie Canterbury. My guest today is Steve Hampton with the Rain Shadow Bird Alliance, formerly Admiralty Audubon. Steve is the conservation chair and is involved in the Christmas bird count, which is what we're going to talk about today. Today's program will focus attention to the longest running citizen science project in the world, the CBC or Christmas bird count. This year is actually the 126th year of the annual census by volunteer bird watchers. It actually began in response to a holiday tradition known as the side hunt, where hunters who shot the most birds and mammals won. The idea of conservation in 1900 was just beginning, and many citizens and scientists alike were becoming very alarmed about the visibly declining bird populations. Enter Frank Chapman, an ornithologist who proposed a new tradition, a Christmas bird census that would count birds during the holiday rather than hunt them. To date, over 300 peer-reviewed articles have resulted from analysis done with the Christmas bird count and the data that has been used by U.S. federal agencies as a very important basis for making decisions about birds. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. This is a small bird that comes to our feeders year-round and is here in winter. Welcome to Nature Now, Steve. One of your responsibilities with Rain Shadow Bird Alliance is the Christmas bird count. What I'd like to talk about today is helping us understand the dynamics of the Port Townsend CBC, or Christmas bird count, and how we can contribute. And remember, listeners, you can add to a century of citizen science by joining a count next year. It's probably too late for this year. But Steve, can you give us some hints?
The Christmas bird count is tomorrow. Gosh.
Yes.
It's tomorrow.
The 20th.
And it's our 49th. It's the 49th Port Townsend Christmas bird count. Christmas bird counts have been going on since the year 1900. That's when they started. And they started nationwide with 25 different counts from California to Boston and Toronto and New York on that first year. And they organized that, of course, without email. I guess they use Pony Express, something. And since then, there's 2,700 counts. They're all in North and South America. In Europe, they do other citizen science things. And it's the largest, probably the single largest citizen science data collection that involves field work, like boots on the ground in the field. And I should explain that each count is a circle. It's a 15-mile diameter circle.
Okay.
And inside that, we try and count every bird. Of course, we don't have access to every place, but that's what we try and do. Divide it up into sections. We have different teams. And our count circle goes from, it's pretty much the whole Kemper Peninsula. It goes all the way down to Eagle Mount Road, Matz is at the kind of the 5 o'clock position, goes up, includes all of Marrowstone. So it's basically everything from Egg and I and Eagle Mount all the way up to Port Townsend.
Who can participate? And what is the date of this year's account? We talked about the date. It's tomorrow.
It is tomorrow.
A little bit late, but good for next year for people to know and sign up early.
Yeah. So they're not necessarily on Christmas Day. In fact, they're almost never on Christmas Day. There's a count window. I think it's December 14th to January 5th. Ours is, by tradition, the first Saturday of the count period. So that's why we're on the 20th this year. Yeah, so these counts are organized by different organizations, usually Audubon chapters in Port Townsend. That's Rain Shadow Bird Alliance. And you could Google Christmas bird counts in Washington. You could Google Squim, Port Angeles, whatever, and probably find it pretty quickly. Anyone can participate. It's traditionally a great time for beginners. And if you ask, If you ask people that are birders how they got into it, I think probably the most common answer is through a Christmas bird count.
Really? So you don't have to know birds to join the group?
You don't. I mean, we're not going to send people that don't know, that are beginners out alone.
Sure, you're going to put them with somebody that is a good birder.
So every team has experienced people, mm-hmm. and I make it a point for the Port Townsend count that every team has room for beginners, because I do view this as an important outreach opportunity.
Sure.
My team tomorrow is going to include a 10-year-old and a 13-year-old, and so I'm very excited about that.
And my count tomorrow is going to include a 70-year-old and a 30-year-old.
Perfect.
Yeah, so it will be very good.
It's a multi-generational
It's a multi-generational hobby. Task. It is. And the data is used to track increasing and decreasing bird species, correct?
So we count all these birds because mm-hmm. we're collecting data.
And where does it go?
Yeah, so the keeper of Christmas bird count data is National Audubon Society. There's a website where you could look up the data. And generally, that since we now have a 100-year 126 year database. That's for some counts. Most counts, though, are 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 years old, which is a really long data set. In the natural world, there's not too many like mm-hmm. university field stations or, you know, research centers that have been around for that long. And so it's increasingly unique. The data gets more valuable the older it is, like the longer the time series. And suddenly, Christmas bird count data is really in demand by researchers because of climate change. So our data goes back way before climate change, and it's showing up in lots of research papers now.
So the data behind climate change and the data that we are accumulating for birds are sort of tied together in looking at the impacts of climate change on our bird species.
Yeah, so humans are like more like frogs in a pot here. I think we're way too high in the food chain to notice.
Sure.
Plants, flowering plants, when trees first leaf out, when the first caterpillar larvae come out, those are highly sensitive to weather and temperature. And so there's a lot of data that shows those things are happening 2 to 3 weeks earlier than they used to happen across the country. Most birds are primary users of those resources. So birds also are noticing the changing climate. And so that's why birds are showing us what is happening. And so what we've been seeing for the last 20, 30, 35 years, there is a noticeable shift in the natural world around 1985, I'm going to say. The same year that I think, what's his name, Jim Hansen presented climate change to Congress.
To Congress.
So that's the year that there was kind of, and it's not just birds, and I mean, it's like fish, it's all kinds of
our natural world.
It's all kinds of things. It started shifting in 1985 and then increasing shifts since then. And so the Christmas bird count data shows those, you know, these aberrations around mm-hmm. in the late 80s, early 90s. And then, you know, at the time, they were just bumps in the data. But now we've seen they were the beginning of an exponential curve. And so we used to have 0, 1, 2, 3 hummingbirds on our count. And then we started to get a few more. And now we get about 170 hummingbirds.
Anna's hummingbirds.
Anna's hummingbirds. Mm-hmm. Our Rufus hummingbirds are migratory. Mm-hmm. So they still go south in the winter. They're in Mexico or Central America.
And the Anna's stay here due to climate change and possibly due to feeders as well.
Both. Both. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. They are definitely dependent on feeders. But I'll say this. They are expanding north at about 5 times faster than they're expanding south or east.
Interesting.
And there's feeders everywhere.
Sure, which is true of many species that are expanding north.
Yeah. California scrub jays are now resident in Port Townsend.
Correct.
We'll get those on the count.
Didn't used to be.
Did not used to be.
Mm-hmm.
No. They kind of only have really arrived in the last 5 to 10 years. Starting to see some other birds moving up. Black phoebes, lesser goldfinch. Those are still rare in this area, but there are black phoebes and lesser goldfinches being seen around the Salish Sea right now. There was a lesser goldfinch at a feeder in Squim last week. So there's these indications
that things are changing.
Of new species coming north from California and Oregon. And then there's other patterns we're seeing on our count data. Should I talk about that?
Yeah, it'd be great.
We're seeing birds that winter mostly north of here. We're seeing those decreasing on our count as if they're wintering further north, and so we're seeing less of them.
Examples?
All the diving ducks. Scoters, black scoters, long-tailed ducks, white-winged scoters, most of the grebes, some of the loons, greater scaup. Yeah, those are birds that are probably, I mean, they could be declining, like range-wide, worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because of effects on the breeding grounds, and that's probably happening. And they can also be shifting their range, their winter range further north, so we don't see them as much in the winter.
So the surf scoter, and you mentioned this in your talk the other night, I found it really interesting, you know, what's happening to diving ducks like scoters.
Yeah.
And I looked it up. The surf scoter has been declining since 1978 in the Salish Sea.
And in California, too.
In California, too.
So it's a range-wide thing.
And their habitat is eelgrass beds.
In the winter.
In the winter, yeah. which we know are decreasing. It's a very sensitive habitat.
And in the summer, they nest on lakes in the Canadian Shield.
And they have a very low reproductive rate.
Yeah, they're long-lived, slow reproducing.
And that's the classic species that tends to have trouble.
Yeah.
2 to 3 years of age before breeding.
Yeah.
And then that depends on adult survivorship as well. So there are complicated indicator species of that type of bird.
Yeah. And they're still trying to figure out exactly why they're declining. Mm-hmm. They might be like some of these long-distance migrant songbirds.
Yes.
That they come up here, and these birds, you would think that a bird that flies, then migrates 1,000 miles can adapt to climate change because they're used to flying thousands of miles to find the right spot. But these long-distance migrants we're finding are really hardwired by day length.
Yes.
So when the day is 14 hours long on April 20th, they migrate, they go up, they start, they lay their eggs. And that's not changing with climate change,
no,
the day length.
But the food resources are.
Yeah, so they're missing the peak insects by 2 or 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting up there late.
Yes.
Because everything is moving faster with the warmer springs. So there's a lot of studies and stories about that, of species not being able to raise their young because they're missing that. I'm wondering if that could be the case with scoters, because we know that they are experts at timing, because they stage here in Puget Sound, and they all like migrate to Canada and Alaska, and they all like range wide across the north. They all lay their eggs like on the same day across the whole continent.
So they're synchronized.
They're synchronized, which means they're attuned to the timing. And
very
I'm thinking
much so. And the whatever timing is changing.
And whatever they're eating up there in those lakes, maybe that's earlier.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it almost certainly is earlier.
So things aren't synchronized anymore like they used to be.
Right, right. So the whole thing is a timing problem.
And you know, I think that, you know, from my knowledge, when you are a bird that has a really low reproductive rate, it's tough. And when you synchronize with your parents and they miss it, it's a tough one. So that's a good example with the scoters. So for any of you who may be just tuning in, this is Jackie Canterbury with KPTZ's Nature Now program. I'm talking with Steve Hampton about our local Christmas bird count, which takes place tomorrow, the 20th. So Steve, really good conversation. Thank you. So that leads me into how have some of the bird numbers, we've discussed some of the birds, like scoters, for example, how have they changed through time? A few more birds in terms of changing food chain.
Sure. So I just talked about birds that are declining here on the count.
Yes.
And those tend to be birds that are wintering further north or yes. declining for other reasons. We have a bunch that are increasing on our count.
Okay.
And these are mostly species that normally winter further south. Like these are birds that normally would winter in California and Oregon and a little bit here, but now we're getting more and more of them. So it's like their winter range is shifting more into our neighborhood and we are seeing more of them simply because they're wintering further north. And so examples would be yellow-rumped warbler, white-crowned sparrow, hermit thrush, Townsend's warbler. We're starting to get more orange-crowned warblers. They're still pretty rare.
Any of the jays?
Jays are pretty resident. California jays are just moving up as
that's what I was thinking.
As a species. Those are the main ones.
Those are the main ones?
Yeah. Oh, cedar waxwings. Yeah. I mean, they're pretty erratic. Oh, American goldfinch. We have set records in American goldfinch and cedar waxwing the last few years.
And cedar waxwings and berries.
Yes. And so what happens is if our winters are warmer.
They stay on the vine.
The berries are still good.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're having right now, as I just read, this is our warmest winter so far in history. And I know at my house, until this last week,
yes.
I think we went 3 weeks in a row with the overnight low above 46.
Correct.
In fact, I have a honeysuckle vine that it has a blooming flower on it.
And I have fuchsias that are still in full bloom.
What I learned when I was in Northern California is that we went through a stage where we no longer got freezes. This is in the Sacramento area. When we no longer got freezes in winter. And that was a real threshold. Because suddenly, the berries and the insects around those berries are still there.
So there's still food.
Through the winter. Yeah. And so we started getting overwintering tanagers, orioles, warblers, vireos, flycatchers. It was pretty crazy.
So I wanted to talk about black turnstones and bandtail pigeons.
Okay. Because
you mentioned that as well. You mentioned those two species in your talk. And I found that it was very interesting that the bandtail pigeon, because I get them here, and mm-hmm. we get them on Maristone, probably a flock of about 30 regularly. And what's going on with bandtail pigeons?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
They're a bit of an enigma.
They're a forest pigeon. Their habitat is coniferous forests. People often don't think of pigeons as being adapted to the coniferous forests, but they are.
They love madrones.
And they also live in cities.
And bandtail pigeons are actually found in mountain forests
all the way
down through South America.
And so ours are thought to migrate to California.
Yeah, but are you seeing any now lately?
No.
I think we don't see many on the Christmas count. They're declining on our count. I mean, they are really kind of like cedar waxwings. They follow the food, and they're pretty episodic. And so it could be what's happening in our count circle, mm-hmm. but it could be what's happening in Oregon or California that's pulling them somewhere else. It's really hard to say. I know I usually don't see any until like May
in Port Townsend.
Whereas I know people like in the foothills above Quilcene see them much earlier.
And how about the black turnstone?
Yeah, so black turnstones, we have a group of about 300 that spend the winter here every year. They bounce around between Flagler and the waterfront in Port Townsend, Point Hudson at low tide. I think a lot of times they're on the outer jetty of the port of Port Townsend, so you can't see them unless you go out in a boat. They're awesome. It's a really one of the largest winter flocks on the coast. Like when I tell people when I report on eBird that I have 300 port black turnstones, first of all, the eBird warning flag comes up. Yeah.
You
have seen too many.
Yes.
Please explain. I counted their legs and divided by two.
And they're very coastal, and they breed up in the Arctic?
Yeah, almost all the sandpipers breed up
mm-hmm.
in the...
Western Arctic?
In the Arctic, yeah. So they like it here. Range-wide, I don't know their status. Most of the shorebirds are declining range-wide because they breed in the Arctic, and the Arctic
yes.
it has experienced twice the global warming that that we have, it's difficult to study in the Arctic because it's difficult to get there.
And then, you know, the next question I would have, you know, if you're having trouble at the northern extent of the landmass, where do you go from there?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the top rung of the ladder issue. That top rung of the ladder issue is birds that can't move further up. So that's not just birds in the Arctic. It's also birds of high elevation, like ptarmigan, Canada jay. And it's also birds of salt marshes with sea level rise. And because those salt marshes are not really going to march up the land because they're all surrounded by riprap and railroad tracks and cities and freeways. And the salt marsh species are kind of in the same bucket.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the diving ducks. Do you have any species in our local Christmas bird count that top the charts nationwide?
We do. We have led the nation. Golden crown kinglets.
Golden crown kinglets. Yeah. Hear them every day in the trees.
Which means your hearing is excellent. We've led the nation in redneck grebes, which is really cool. We've led the nation in ancient murrelets, which is kind of a specialty species. It's so it's in the Alcid family, which is basically the puffin family. But it's how big are ancient murrelets? They're about the size of a Coke can, maybe.
Yeah,
right. They're very tiny. They're round.
Round.
They're black and white and gray. They've got a little white bill tip. They fly in these little bundles of usually 4 to 12 birds, and they come down here in the winter. The center of their breeding range is Haida Gwaii. They nest on the ground under like tree roots in the forest. And then when the chicks hatch, they march through the forest to the water. And then once they hit the water, they're out to sea with their parents. They have been confirmed nesting on some of the sea stacks off Washington for the first time. They were long suspected nesting.
Off the sea stacks?
Well, on those islands.
Okay.
And now they were confirmed last year by Washington Fish and Wildlife for the first time. Yeah. So that's pretty cool. But most people, the only way to see them for most people is you got to come to the Pacific Northwest in the winter. And a lot of birders just don't do that.
They don't want to do that.
And so there's these birders that do this like big year in the United States. Right. And ancient murrelet is often their last bird because they just don't.
They don't
come to the Pacific Northwest in the winter unless they really want to see an ancient murrelet.
Well, yesterday, after being out there in that rain, I don't blame them.
Yeah.
So another question is about the feeder watch. So tomorrow I'm going to do the count, but also I've been trying to get my neighborhood, local neighborhood involved in the feeder watch and get people to watch their bird feeders. Can you explain a little bit about how people can get involved?
Yeah.
And who sponsors it?
Yeah. So there's two feeder watch things. There's Project Feeder Watch, and then there's being a feeder watcher on the Christmas bird count. And I'm going to talk about that first because I'm a big fan of that. For people that don't want to walk around in the rain all day, you could do a feeder watch from your home for the Christmas bird count. And basically, you just choose a 30-minute window when all the birds are coming and count them and report them. Last year, we had 22 dedicated feeder watchers. I think our number's going up this year.
And then you report them to you.
Yeah.
Send them to your email address. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do with them?
They go into the Christmas bird count total. We track party hours or effort.
Mm-hmm.
And feeder watchers are obviously not covering any distance because they're stationary from their home. And also, I should add, the birds don't have to be at the feeder if they're in the bushes or anywhere. You see them from your window.
That's okay.
You can count them.
How about a bald eagle that never comes to your feeder?
You can count it. Yeah.
You can?
Okay. Yeah. Flybys, sure. Yeah. So first of all, it's a great way for people to participate if they can't be out for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are sick, people are not mobile.
And so you're saying is you just count for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
On the same day as the formal count is, the Christmas bird count.
Yeah.
And how's that different from feeder watch in general?
Yeah, so there's Project Feeder Watch, which is a separate nationwide issue. Effort. Project Feeder Watch is through Cornell, Lab of Ornithology.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Which is the same as eBird and, Merlin.
And Merlin.
Project Feeder Watch, you sign up for online. You can type in Project Feeder Watch. There you can do it through the winter. Actually, they only let you do it once a week.
Ah.
You have to take a break. So that it's a separate protocol. You have a two-day window. You can just look out whenever you feel like it. They realize people come and go. People have jobs. And in the course of that two-day window, you enter in the high count of, like, say you look out at one moment and there's six golden crown sparrows. And then you look out later the next day and there's seven. Then you enter seven for golden crown sparrow. And so you just enter in the maximum for each species during a two-day window. They don't want flybys, by the way. They want birds. They don't have to come to the feeder, but they have to be using your
habitat.
Your yard.
Your yard.
So that's Project Feeder Watch.
And you send that data to Cornell?
Yeah. There's an app for your phone, or there's an online interface.
So if someone was interested in doing it, you just go to Cornell, the Cornell site.
Yeah.
And look up Feeder Watch.
I would just type in Project Feeder Watch.
Project Feeder Watch.
Yeah. And that data, which has been around for years, mm-hmm. is also being used in a lot of studies. In fact, the big research on the northward push of Anna's hummingbirds and lesser goldfinches is based on Project Feeder Watch data.
Oh, interesting. So all these scientific projects are so important. And what's wonderful about them is that anybody can get involved and contribute to science.
And, well, it's like, it's data from the people. I mean, that's data what they're relying on.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredibly done. Well, thank you, Steve, very much. Any passing comments before we end today?
Yeah.
Happy Christmas bird count.
Yeah, happy Christmas bird count. Come join us on the Christmas bird count next year, and or be a feeder watcher for the Christmas bird count, and you could sign up for Project Feeder Watch at any time.
Thank you. Thanks again, Steve. And have a good day tomorrow.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. This is Jackie Canterbury. Let's return to our mystery sound, which is the Anna's hummingbird. Birds withstand cold and freezing temperatures by entering what we call torpor, which is a state of deep semi-hibernation where they lower their metabolism and body temperature by about 20 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. They now depend upon our feeders in winter with a mix of sugar water that contains about 1/4 cup white sugar to 1 cup water. They can supplement their diet also with tree sap and insects. But this time of year, your clean feeders become very important to sustain these birds. So with that, thank you all very much for listening. And we hope you have enjoyed our program of information about the natural community where we live. We're all so lucky. In addition to finding the Nature Now podcast on the KPTZ website, you can listen to the shows on the podcast app in your smartphone. Just search for Nature Now. Here you can access both older and current episodes. Plus, we are now on Instagram.